Did you please close the door?
No, you haven't. So he's about to get up and close the door. That means he understood something. Upon hearing my request or command to close the door, he acted on it. How come? How do we explain that when he understood my request, he acted on it? What kind of a story do we need to tell to make sense of that very simple fact? Right? That's what this is about. It's an attempt at trying to explain how you account for people acting on command utterances, essentially. And there's massive debates about this, as there is with most things. So anyway, that's the basic problem. And it was trying to also situate it within a broader context of things that relate to religion or something. All right. So Gangesha's 14th century wish-fulfilling jewel of reality, which is how I'm translating Tattva Chintamani, is arguably the most influential Sanskrit philosophical text of the second millennium. In many ways, it was a philosopher's stone for Sanskrit intellectuals, as an astonishing variety of writers throughout history turned to it and the discussions it generated to test, refine, and in some cases transform their views on the sources of knowledge and the diverse philosophical issues that were discussed in terms of them. It's fair to say there was not a single Sanskrit knowledge system that was not influenced in its language, methodology, and understanding of philosophical problems and solutions by Gangesha's jewel. Its significance to the history of Sanskrit philosophy and to the history of Sanskrit intellectual practices more generally is thus difficult to overestimate. It was Gangesha's jewel that set the philosophical agenda, both methodologically and substantively, well into the 20th century. Like almost every Sanskrit philosopher who preceded and succeeded him, Gangesha was deeply interested in philosophical issues that we would, without hesitation, identify as belonging to the contemporary philosophy subfields of epistemology, philosophy of language, philosophy of mind, and metaphysics. It is, however, astonishing that he, like almost every Sanskrit philosopher who preceded and succeeded him, did not write anything that we would, without hesitation, identify as belonging to the contemporary subfield of ethics, as we've talked about. In fact, some might go so far to say that ethics was not considered by classical Indian philosophers to be a subfield of philosophy at all. While this is the case, arguably, for ethics narrowly construed, I will argue that it's not at all the case for metaethics. My argument is based on a neglected chapter from the third book of Gangesha's Jewel, the book on testimony. The stated purpose of this neglected chapter, the chapter on command utterances, is an inquiry into how scriptural injunctions, right, that is, Vedic utterances expressive of commands, are fundamental for scripturally sanctioned human action, such as the performance of this or that Vedic ritual. We are told more specifically that such utterances are fundamental in that they generate instigating awareness, pravartaka jnana, that is, awareness events that lead ultimately and in principle to action. Yet it is very clear from Gangesha's jewel that the scope of this chapter extends far beyond scripturally sanctioned human action, and in fact that its purpose is to develop and defend a theory of action in general. In this paper, I provide a preliminary interpretation of Gangesha's theory of action and argue, more specifically, that the philosophical issues most central to it have to do with what is called motivation to the means, and two related issues having to do with the sources of normativity and, perhaps surprisingly, linguistic force. When the chapter on command utterances is understood in this way, it becomes much easier to appreciate why the issue of what Vedic utterances convey was such an important one for late pre-modern and early modern Sanskrit philosophers and theologians. It also forces us to confront the embarrassing fact that has been almost completely neglected in contemporary scholarship, especially by students of Indian philosophy, who are far too easily scared off by texts or sections of texts that even appear to be about religion. My paper begins with a brief introduction to the conceptual vocabulary that Gangesha uses to present his theory of action, and then turns to a preliminary analysis of it. Through this analysis, I introduce the philosophical issues that I believe are at the center of Gangesha's chapter on command utterances, and explain how they inform his account of action. Once these issues are in view, their significance to meta-ethics will, I trust, be readily apparent. Whether there is any merit to Gangesha's view is something that I hope we can discuss, as I'm not yet sure that I fully understand it, let alone know what to make of it. The conceptual vocabulary that Gangesha uses to discuss the philosophy of action was inherited from his Nyaya Vaisheshika predecessors, and in fact was shared by almost all Sanskrit philosophers. In broad outline, Gangesha argues that instigating awareness, this is pravartaka jnana, generates a desire to act. That's what this first handout is, right? So the arrows are some kind of transition. So instigating awareness generates a desire to act, which then leads to something called mental effort, which is itself directed toward a particular action, which, among other things, is believed to be a means to a desired end, ishta sadhana. It is this mental effort that I refer to as motivation to the means, right? So you understand something when you hear a command utterance. That awareness is pravartaka jnana. It's an awareness that causes you to act or that pushes you. That awareness generates a desire to act. That desire to act leads to a motivation to act upon the means to attain some end. And it's that motivation that then leads you to actually act. All right? That's the story. It's important to note that for Nyaya Vaisheshika philosophers like Gangesha, awareness, that's jnana, desire, icha, including the desire to act, chikirsha, and mental effort, kriti, right? So awareness, desire, and effort are properties that belong uniquely to the self, right? So they're located in the Atman, they're gunas of the Atman. Of these three special properties of the self, only awareness is, strictly speaking, a mental event, in that it alone has mental content. All right, so what does that mean? So when you understand an utterance, you have a kind of jnana, a kind of cognition, a kind of awareness. In the case of command utterances that you act upon, it's called instigating awareness. Awareness is a thing. And what kind of a thing is it? It's considered to be a property. All properties have to be located in some kind of a bucket, right? What's the bucket where this property is located? It's the bucket of the Atma. Sorry, not really a bucket. The Atma is the dharmi, in which the dharma, or the guna, is related through a certain kind of relation. Now, so that generates a desire. But you have to ask, what is a desire? Well, you might think that a desire is a kind of cognition, a kind of awareness. It's not. Neither is effort. Right? The only thing that's considered awareness here is jnana. A desire and effort are actually things. All right, jnana is a thing too, but it's a different kind of thing. It isn't located in the self. We'll get into that a little bit more later. So, although neither desire nor mental effort are themselves awareness events, what does that mean? That means they're not cognitions. They can be the contents of one. So that means that cognition is about something, right? So cognitions can be about other cognitions, that's fine. But cognitions can also be about desires. Cognitions can be about effort. So when you say, I desire X, right? That desire for X is not a cognition. It's something about which you can have a cognition. So it's the content of a cognition, just like a table or a chair, right? So furthermore, although neither desire nor mental effort has mental content, what does that mean? Well, they're not mental events, so they can't be about something. So they don't have mental content. So desires don't have mental content. Effort doesn't have mental content. Both are often described as though they do. In such cases, it's important to keep in mind that they're having content, being about something, or being object-directed, is entirely dependent upon an awareness event and its content. So why did I bother? Often when people write about desire or effort in Nyaya, they confuse it with awareness. And the reason they do is because in the text themselves, it often appears as though they are a kind of cognition. But that's just derivative. So it's better to remember that desire and effort are something different. That's all that matters here. So debates about the philosophy of action and much of Sanskrit philosophy, therefore, focus on the content of this instigating awareness and how such awareness motivate, prompt, or push an agent to direct their effort toward the believed means to a desired end via the intermediary of that agent's desire to act upon that means. All right? Make sense? So I'm thirsty. So I have instigating awareness. I want water. That instigating awareness produces in me a desire to act, right, to maybe get a glass. that motivates me to seek out an appropriate container. This is not a very good paraphrase. And then I act and pick up the container or something like that. All right, we'll get a specific example.
So where's effort in all this?
Effort is motivation to the means.
So motivation is the effort.
That's the effort, yeah. And you can there's a paraphrase which will explain that. All right. So in his account of linguistic awareness, Gangesha not only describes and analyzes the content of these instigating awareness events, but he also explains how such awareness events were produced and how a desire to act upon the means and the motivation to it are related to these contents. Of particular interest to me and also of interest to Gangesha is how the transitions from instigating awareness to a desire to act, right, that's transition one, and from a desire to act to motivation to the means are to be accounted for. In general, Gangesha's account of these transitions is presented from a third-person standpoint of evaluation. That is, from the standpoint of someone who is interested in assessing and evaluating the actions undertaken by an agent. So what does that mean? Gangesha is not trying to tell you what it feels like for you to hear an utterance or a command utterance and act on it. He actually doesn't care what you think. What he wants to do is provide an explanatory account, a theoretical framework that will make sense of what you in fact do and the steps along the way. So on the one hand, one thing about Sanskrit philosophers and theoreticians more generally, especially in philosophy, is believe it or not, they're trying to provide what I'll call humanly binding accounts or humanly binding theories. What does that mean? Well, it's supposed to be theoretically adequate and accurate in the first instance, even though it may not be common sense. Yet, it has to be something that also you can assent to, something that makes that grips you in some way that it seems to make sense. This is particularly true of epistemology, but it's also true, though to a lesser extent, of theories of action. Right? So it's not meant to be psychologically descriptive. So it has a bit of a normative or explanatory commitment, a component to it. So if you say, well, it doesn't feel like that to me, right? That's not, he'll say, so. Right? He'll say, well, once I convince you of the theory, you'll see that this provides a good, adequate explanation for what you're doing, even though initially it doesn't feel like that to you, right? It doesn't have to be a common sense explanation to be one that's correct, just like most of science, nor one that's supposed to be humanly binding, that you're supposed to recognize as being right. Okay? So through his account of these transitions, that's transition one and two, Gangesha seeks to provide what seem to be what's called both motivating and normative reasons for them. That is, he seeks to provide an account of why instigating awareness is motivationally efficacious, and also why failing to be so motivated by it is, for example, censurable. So this is important, right? If there's a command and you act on it, fine. If you don't act on it, Gangesha says you can be censured for it. What does that mean? The fact that you can be censured suggests that it's not just psychological, right? There's a normative, an evaluative component to it. If you do, you should have acted on it. Right? What's the force of that should? You ought to have. Or someone who desires heaven should perform the Agnishtoma. That's normative. If you don't, bad things will happen. Where does that normative force come from?
Kant.
Actually, it's not at all Kant here. This is Humean, far more than Kantian. The Prabhakaras might be more Kantian, but that's a separate story. Okay. So before turning to an analysis of these transitions, it's helpful to first consider what Gangesha has to say about instigating awareness and how it's produced. So all I'm trying to do is explain to you what he says and trying to interpret it in some way. So while scriptural commands are taken to be the paradigmatic producers of instigating awareness, any source of knowledge can, in principle, generate it. Thus, not only can Vedic utterances, such as the paradigmatic, a person desirous of heaven ought to perform the new and full moon sacrifice, lead to instigating awareness, but, as Gangesha makes clear, ordinary utterances can too. For example, the utterance, a person desirous of cooked rice ought to cook rice grains. For someone who is hungry for rice, of course. Furthermore, since, according to Gangesha, even pre-linguistic infants can be motivated to the means, as, for example, when they direct themselves to suckle at the breast of their mothers, it's clear that instigating awareness is not simply the result of testimony. In the case of the baby, for example, it results from what is called an inference for oneself. And while Gangesha does not discuss an example of instigating awareness that results from perception, it's clear that perception too can at least contribute to the production of an awareness event, as, for example, when a person ducks to avoid getting hit by a baseball. In each of these cases, a person is motivated to act on the basis of an instigating awareness event. Since testimony is a paradigmatic source for instigating awareness, however, my discussion will focus on it. So look what he's trying, look what he says. Someone who desires heaven, someone who desires heaven ought to perform the Agnishtoma sacrifice, the new and full moon sacrifice, right? Not the Agnishtoma. The person will, that'll generate instigating awareness, right? A baby also has instigating awareness, which motivates her to suckle at the breast of her mother when she's hungry. Someone who's hungry for cooked rice has the same instigating awareness when they act to cook the rice. Someone who ducks to avoid getting hit by a baseball has the same instigating awareness. So this account of instigating awareness, which is developed in the context of Vedic command utterances, is meant to be a much more general account. All right. One thing that should strike people as weird, people who are used to Western philosophy of language, is that it's totally counterintuitive for anyone who does Euro-American philosophy of language to start with commands. You start with assertions. You never start with commands. It just makes no sense. But the way this develops is by starting with commands. Okay. So I'm going to focus on testimony, not the others, right? So as an example, consider the content of the instigating awareness event that's produced when a competent speaker of a language correctly understands a token utterance containing a deontic modal, such as the utterance, "A person desirous of rice ought to cook rice grains." According to Gangesha, the content of this awareness event is constituted by a number of components that correspond to the semantic values of the three complex terms that make up the utterance. So the agent, right, the person desirous of rice, the finite verb, the akyata, in this case the optative third person singular, ought to cook, and the patient, rice grains. Each of these terms is complex, in the sense that each itself is made up of more than one component word, according to Nayayikas. For our purposes, of greatest importance is the semantic value of the finite verb, right? Which is itself composed from the semantic value of two component words, the underlying verbal root, right, the dhatu, and the verbal suffix, the thing, right? According to Gangesha, the semantic value of a verbal root, this is the dhatu artha, is an intermediary activity that leads to a result. Right, so what are we interested in? We're interested in the finite verb, which is made up of two parts, the root part and the ending part. Each of them convey some meaning. According to Gangesha, what the root part conveys is an intermediary activity that leads to a result. It's pala anukula vyapara. So what the dhatvartha conveys is this vyapara, which is pala anukula vyapara. That is, what is conveyed by the underlying root of the finite verb ought to be is the intermediary activity that leads to the softening of the rice grains. What's the pala? It's pala, result. I forgot how I translated it. Intermediary activity that leads to the result. What's the result? The softening of the rice grains, right? And that's the intermediary activity that leads to the result. So ought to cook conveys that intermediary activity. Thus, what is conveyed by the underlying root of the finite verb ought to cook is the intermediate activity leads to the softening of the rice, right? It's this vikliti, anukula vyapara. The semantic value of the verbal suffix, according to Gangesha, is the mental effort that, in relevant cases, the agent in question directs toward the intermediary activity that is expressed by the underlying verbal root. All right, so what's up here? We're talking about should cook. We've got two parts. We've got the cook part and the should part, right? The cook part, what does that mean? Cook part refers to an action. What kind of an action? An action which is the functioning intermediary that gets you to the result, right? And that's a kind of, let's say, the result is softening. So whatever activity gets you to the softening, whatever intermediary activity, that's the cook part. The should part has a generic part and a specific part. The generic part is shared by all verbal endings, and the specific part is what optatives have or commands have in addition to whatever the generic indicative verbs have, let's say. So the semantic value of the suffix is basically the mental effort. It's kriti, right? It's the effort that in the relevant cases the agent directs toward the intermediary activity that is expressed by the underlying root, okay? So in the sentence Devadatta is cooking rice grains, for example, the semantic value of the third person singular present indicative ending of the verb is cooking is the effort the Devadatta directs toward cooking the rice grains, right? Devadatta is cooking rice grains. What is the ending? Pachati, right? What does the ti do here? It conveys something. It has to mean something. What it conveys is Devadatta's effort. What the root conveys is this intermediate activity. Does that make sense? Okay. For Gangesha, a finite verb conveys that the agent in question is directing, has directed, or will direct their effort toward an intermediary activity that leads to a result. It conveys, in other words, an agent's motivation to the means. So I'm saying this effort is best interpreted as a motivation to the means, not to the end. In discussion of command utterances, however, it is a semantic value of specifically deontic modals such as optatives that is usually at issue. According to Gangesha, what is additionally conveyed by optative suffixes are the following three properties of the intermediary activity that is expressed by the underlying verbal root. I'll explain this in a minute. These are the property that the activity can be brought about with effort, right? Swakriti sadhyatva, really with one's own effort. The property that it is in fact a means to a desired end, that is ishta sadhanatva, and the property that it does not lead to an even more undesired end, right? Thus, according to Gangesha, what is conveyed by the utterance, a person desirous of rice ought to cook rice grains, is, from our third-person standpoint, that a person who currently desires cooked rice will direct their effort towards some intermediary activity of cooking, which is an action that that person judges can be brought about through her own effort, is a means to her desired end, and does not lead to something worse, right? To an even more undesired end. In other words, what is conveyed is that for some action phi, an agent believes that phi is a means to her currently desired end, that it can be brought about by her own effort, and that it does not lead to an even more undesired end. Notice that the complex content of this agent's awareness can be described by three that clauses, each of which predicates a property of the action by. Let's see. All right, this is here on instigating awareness. Let's see if this is going to work. Each of these that clauses also exhibits what has been called a word-to-world or mind-to-world direction of fit. Mind-to-world or word-to-world direction of fit, in the sense that each is supposed to fit the way the world is. Does that make sense? It's supposed to fit the way the world is. In such awareness events, the content is grasped as fitting or being patterned after the world. In contrast, desires and commands are taken to exhibit a world-to-word or world-to-mind direction of fit, in the sense that the contents of such awareness events is grasped as a pattern that the world is supposed to fit or conform to, right? So if I say, the book is on the table, right? That is a word-to-world direction of fit in the sense that the utterance is supposed to capture the way the world is. Suppose I say, Gopal, please put the book on the table. Please put the book on the table does not capture the way the world is. It's the way I want the world to be. So that's called, the terminology is terrible, a world-to-word direction of fit. Right? So in the sense that the content of such awareness events is grasped as a pattern that the world is supposed to fit or conform to, right? It's not yet that way. Notice, too, that the agent's own awareness, in fact, that phi has any of these properties is fallible, in the sense that our agent could be mistaken about phi possessing any one of them, right? What Gangesha needs to explain is how instigating awareness, with its word-to-world direction of fit, leads to a desire to phi, with its world-to-word direction of fit. There is, however, right, is that okay? There is, however, a feature of instigating awareness that complicates this picture somewhat, sadly. All right. So everyone get the project. If you don't feel the force of what he's trying to do, it's going to be a real sleeper. So the force is, your mission impossible, should you choose to accept it, is to provide a rigorous account why a rigorous account that make that explains how and why it is that when someone acts on the basis of a command, that explains how and why someone acts on the basis of a command. That's the task. And so what we've done now is just lay out the vocabulary. Maybe the added task should be why the person should be in trouble if they don't do that in certain cases, right? So there's a normative component to it. We need to get a few more things on the table, and then we can get to the messy part. According to Gangesha, there are two categories of desired ends. Those that are primary and those that are secondary. He claims further that pleasure and the absence of suffering, dukkha bhava, are our only primary ends. Right? This means the means to our primary ends can also be desired, but as Gangesha says, they are secondary ends, in the sense that our desire for them is entirely dependent upon our desire for the primary end to which they are the means. So basically, it's a light switch. There's on and off. Those are your primary ends, right? Pleasure, absence of suffering. Everything else is considered an end only in relation to this primary end. Okay, that's a kind of Nyaya peculiarity. So the means to our primary ends, what are our primary ends? Sukha and dukkha bhava. Can also be desired, but as Gangesha says, they're secondary, in the sense that our desire for them is entirely dependent upon our desire for the primary end to which they are the means. Unlike our primary end, these secondary ends are always actions, right? So secondary ends are actions. They're means to the primary end. They're defined in terms of it. Okay. So according to Gangesha, desire for a primary end is generated simply by our awareness of it, in the sense that it is our awareness of pleasure or the absence of suffering that produces a desire for it. It's considered primitive. So the very fact that you... the very fact that you are... How to put it? The very fact that you're aware of pleasure produces a desire for pleasure. The very fact that you're aware of suffering produces a desire for the absence of suffering. There's no other story to tell. And any other story you try to tell will just be a complication, essentially. All right? So if you, in fact, feel pleasure or are aware of pleasure, that'll automatically lead to a desire for it. Otherwise, it's not pleasure. Right? If you are aware of suffering, that'll automatically lead to a desire for the absence of suffering. Why? That's just what happens. That's just the way you're built. And if it doesn't happen, it's because there's a problem. It's either not suffering, you're unconscious, it's not working, you don't have the right jnana, you know, something. All right. So that's a place to push on this. Where am I here? So our awareness that some action is in fact a means to such a desired end is based on what we take to be a source of knowledge. Since the means to such a desired end is an action, our desire for a secondary end just is a desire for the means, upaya icha, which, it is important to note, is not the same as a desire to act upon the means. So here's where it gets kind of weird. So in our main story, we have desire to act, right? This is a desire to act upon the means, right? A desire to act upon the instrument that's going to get you what you want. All right, that's different than a desire for the means, and we'll sort that out. That's kind of key to how I understand this, and I'm not sure it's right. According to Gangesha, a desire for some action, a desire for phi, is not the same as a desire to phi. Gangesha describes a desire to phi, that's chikirsha, as a desire for an action that we are aware we can bring about through our own effort. It's defined as a desire for an action that we are aware we can bring about through our own effort. He sometimes says that a desire to phi can be paraphrased by the expression, I am prompted to make phi happen through my own effort, right? And suggests further that its semantic range includes a variety of what are called pro-attitudes, such as wants, shoulds, and oughts. The only resource that Gangesha has to explain the force of these wants, shoulds, and oughts, interestingly, is the content of instigating awareness. Does that make sense? Let me read one more sentence, I'll explain it. In contrast to the desire to phi, which we just did, a desire for phi is merely and simply a desire that phi happen. So a desire for pleasure is simply a desire that pleasure be experienced. A desire to phi is a desire to act upon the means that will lead to pleasure. Okay? Make sense? Okay. Now look, when you have instigating awareness, that awareness somehow, you're getting pushed. You desire something, that instigating awareness pushes you somehow. Right? When I say, if I said it seriously, Gopal, please close the door. Would you please close the door? And he gets up. He's getting pushed. Where does that come from? I mean, is it what he understands in his head leading to, like, muscle contractions or something? I mean, how does that work? And why is it that if his boss tells him to do something, he doesn't do it, he's going to get in trouble? Where's that in your account? Why is it normative? Where's the should? Where does that force come from? The force of wanting, or the force of shoulding or ought. Where does that normative force come from? There's only one option. You have to explain everything by this. That's all you got. Right? Okay. So Gangesha's view that the agent's awareness that phi is a means to a currently desired end is equivalent to her having a desire for phi somewhat complicates my earlier account of linguistic awareness. It does so by introducing a desire for as a component of the content of instigating awareness, a component which I suggested above may have a different direction of fit than the component that it's supposed to be a replacement for. Regardless of this complication, however, the relevant issue is how instigating awareness, this pravartaka jnana, leads to a desire to phi, chikirsha, and what role, if any, a desire for the end to which phi is the means, that is, a desire for phi, plays in this process. All right. So now we're going to try to explain the first transition. We've done the preliminaries. Okay. So to understand how Gangesha might address this issue, it's necessary to briefly reconsider the three properties that are predicated of phi in a genuinely instigating awareness events. The first property, right, you know what I'm talking about? Remember? What verbal endings generically convey is effort. What optatives or commands convey is that the means possess three properties, right? The property that intermediary action, that instrumental action, can be brought about through your own effort. If you didn't think you could do it, you wouldn't do it. That, I forget the order I gave it to you. There's a traditional order. That it is, in fact, a means to a desired end, right? If you didn't think it was a means to a desired end, you had a desire for some end, you wouldn't do it. So you have to know you can do it. You have to know that it is, in fact, a means to a desired end. And you have to think that doing it won't lead to something that you want less, right? That it'll be worse off if you do it. Like, if, you know, you can imagine how that goes. I think I may have given you better explanation. All this is on one of the pages they hand out. This transition one. So the property that can be brought about with effort, let's call it the capability condition, right? You have the capacity to do it. The property that is, in fact, a means to a desired end. And the property that does not lead to an even more undesired end. Let's call it the relative value condition. Okay. All right, so let's see where we go here. So the first property that phi is a means to a desired end may be helpfully thought of as being made up of two subcomponents, right? A desired end, that is, the end that the agent has a desire for, and an awareness that phi is the means to it. Does that make sense? Does it or not yet? The first property, right, that phi is a means to a desired end, has two parts. It has a desired end part and your knowledge that it is the means. One of Gangesha's opponents argues that an awareness of these two subcomponents is sufficient to account for a desire to act upon the means, that is, to account for a desire to phi. Why do you need the other stuff, right? It's not good if your theory has extra parts. The opponent's view is that a desire for some end, plus the belief that phi is the means to that end, is sufficient to generate a desire to phi. Okay, so the opponent says, look, all you need is this. You just need to have a desire for water, and knowledge that picking up a glass is the means to it, and that will lead to your action. That's all you need. This principle is the opponent's version of what's called the instrumental or means-end norm, for those of you who know about this. It's clear, however, that Gangesha rejects this view. and argues there are in fact two further properties that an agent must be aware that phi has before a desire can be generated. These two properties are that phi can be brought about by the agent. Right? I'll refer to this as the capability condition. And that phi does not lead to an even more undesired end. I'll refer to this as the relative value condition. Without either the capability or relative value conditions being satisfied, Gangesha argues that the awareness that phi is a means to a desired end will not lead to a desire to phi, will not lead to a desire to cook. In his view, while the awareness that phi is the means to a currently desired end is equivalent to having a desire for phi, it does not lead to a desire to phi. That is, it does not lead to a desire to act upon the means. According to Gangesha, there's something else about the content of an instigating awareness event that moves one's mind from an awareness that phi has such and such properties to a desire to phi. That is, from an awareness that has a word-to-world direction of fit to one that has a world-to-word direction of fit. Okay, I've got a little bit more and then we're done. So that's base. I would say that everything that I've said to you now, with the exception of the introduction of this new term, desire for phi, can be easily and directly defended on the base of Gangesha's text itself. I would say there's almost no interpretation. That's my claim in this part of the story. The interpretation comes in two parts. I would even say I can defend the desire to desire for distinction, even though they don't do it in Nyaya itself. The issue then is, what does this mean? How do we make sense of this in order to explain action? Gangesha doesn't. So what follows now is not something that's directly sourced in Gangesha's text. Though my claim would be that if he were here, he would say this is what he's doing, and I can explain to you why, on the basis of what he does write, I think this is the best way to explain and interpret it. Right? I'm not just writing what he said here. The rest you could say is merely, it's relatively simple. I mean, within reason. Right? Okay. So I'd like to suggest, in order to account for this, Gangesha appeals to a broadly dispositional theory of desire, for what it means for an agent to have a desire for phi. According to this theory, phi is desirable for some agent, if and only if that agent would be disposed to phi under certain circumstances. So a desire for phi, some action for cooking, that phi is desirable for some agent, if and only if that agent would be disposed to actually do that under certain circumstances. So if the circumstances were there, then the person would act, would be disposed to act, right? Dispositional like sugar in certain circumstances will dissolve, right? It has a dispositional property to dissolve in certain state. Okay. So the agent would be disposed to phi under certain circumstances, which for Gangesha are the capability and relative value conditions, right? Given the satisfaction of the capability and relative value conditions, Gangesha argues that a desire for phi disposes one to have a desire to phi. That's Chikirsha, right? So that is, the trick is how you get from here to here, right? So you have a desire for phi, which is a component of your instigating awareness, right? Because instigating awareness has that bit that says that it must be a means to a desired end. What kind of desire is that, that desired end? That's not a desire to act. That's a desire for something, right? So how does a desire for something, which is what your awareness is about, get you to a desire to do something, right? How does it basically get you out of your chair? To do it. The claim is that that desire for phi, given certain conditions, leads to a desire to phi. So you have a desire for, I don't know, for something, let's say, water. Or it's actually for getting water, for an action. And you then know that you have the capacity to get it, and that drinking that water, like it doesn't have horrible bacteria that'll kill you in it, that'll lead to good things, then that results in a desire to act. So we've gone from an awareness that has one direction of fit to one that has a different one. We're gone from desire for as a constituent of awareness to a desire to as a constituent of awareness. That's what accounts for transition one. So I say. Uh, So the dispositional interpretation of a desire for, right, thus seems to provide at least what's called a motivating reason for an agent to have a desire to. It does not, however, seem to account for the supposed normative force that Gangesha also takes this transition to have, since it does not seem to be able to account for his view that not forming a desire to in such circumstances is censurable. Is that okay? Desire for getting water, the relative value and capability conditions are met, so then you have a desire to get water. But I said to you that you can be in trouble, censured, if you do not have this desire to. So far, there's nothing in my account that says why you should be censured. It's simply like sugar, under certain circumstances, is going to dissolve. You're not going to blame the sugar. But here you can blame the agent. Where does this ability to blame come from? That's not explained so far. Okay. Acting contrary to a disposition, for example, does not seem to be an act that violates a rational or relevantly similar normative requirement, right? As I understand Gangesha, however, this is something else. There's something else about his dispositional account of a desire for that is supposed to account for what he sees as the normative force of this transition. My suggestion is that for Gangesha, in disposing an agent to phi, when the capability and relative value conditions are satisfied, a desire for phi is supposed to do more than just provide a motivating reason for her desire to phi. The desire for phi, it seems, that's the one, right? Everyone gets this? That's the one of the instigating awareness, right? The desire for phi, it seems, is also supposed to enable an agent to see the satisfaction of the capability and relative value conditions as considerations in favor of her forming a desire to phi. It seems to do, I'll explain in a second. It seems to do so by making these conditions salient to her in a way they would not be if she did not have this desire. Read one more sentence and I'll explain. Her desire, I'll explain now. All right, what does that mean? So her desire for phi, right, I think is also supposed to enable the agent to see that the satisfaction of the capability and relative value conditions, right, to see them as considerations, as reasons, in favor of her acting. So if that desire for, right, has built into it that the agent see that if the capability conditions are satisfied, then she is to act, right? Or as considerations in favor of her acting, there are reasons for acting. You begin to get a little bit of a normative grip. Make sense? No? See, the problem is this. Fine, like sugar. Got sugar, you have desire for. Stick it in water, you have capability conditions, they are in fact satisfied. Sugar dissolves, right? You don't say that sugar is bad if it doesn't dissolve. Well, you might, but you don't. But in this case, if Gopal doesn't close the door and his teacher tells him to, he's going to get in trouble. Where does that wear? Well, suppose that this desire for also has built into it this idea that the agent knows that she ought to act. I mean, I'm conflating a lot of language you shouldn't conflate. That she ought to act if these conditions are satisfied. That when these considerations are satisfied, those are reasons for her to act. So if she knows it's a means to a desired end, if she knows it's not going to really screw her over, that she will act. Right? Those are reasons. And if knowing those reasons she chooses not to act, then I can say, you lose. That's a mistake. You made a mistake. That was wrong. Not just that it didn't happen, but that it's wrong. Okay?
Yeah. The reasons are basically the capability condition and the relative value condition.
It's not the they're not the I'm not using the word reasons deliberately, right? The way I put it is that she sees, you could say knows, that the satisfaction of those conditions are considerations, which you might say are reasons, are considerations in favor of her acting. I don't want to say they're decisive, all right? So I'm just trying to build in the minimal normative vocabulary I need to say it's... Because Gangesha doesn't say this. I think this is what we can talk about what it means to defend this account later. So her desire to phi is therefore an attitude that is sensitive to a judgment that the capability and relative conditions have been satisfied. It is her desire for phi, however, that's inside the head, right, that accounts for why the satisfaction and capability why the satisfaction, the capability, and relative value conditions strike her as salient, and therefore count for her as considerations in favor of her forming a desire to phi. If we can take these considerations in favor of as reasons for her to have a desire to phi, then it seems as though we have found at least two rational requirements for her desire to phi. Does that make sense? In the sense that were she to be unresponsive to them, we could claim that she is irrational. Look, one thing you should ask yourself is, what is a reason?
That was actually my question.
Right.
But what is Gangesh saying is...
So Gangesha is saying... So I'm using the word... I'm saying that Gangesha considers these to be considerations in favor of... Right? So given the satisfaction, an agent is aware that she should form this desire. It's funny, I'm mixing language here, right? So those considerations in favor of are things that are reasons, essentially. I'm not using the word reason deliberately, because reason is a very loaded term. Let me just read the paragraph again. So it's her desire for phi. What does that mean? That's the awareness that something is a means to a desired end, right? Desire for. However, that accounts for why the satisfaction of the conditions strike her as salient. What does that mean? That, oh, if it really is a means to a desired end, and if it isn't going to lead to really bad things for me, then those seem to be considerations in favor of me forming a desire to actually get the water. Now, what is these considerations in favor of? What are those considerations? I don't want to front load it by making them normative right away. But at the very least, they're considerations. So the extent to which, but they seem to me, those considerations, to be kind of reasons.
And where do they exist?
Where do the inner head, what do you mean?
Where do they, are they, the desire to act, or, I mean...
So the desire to act is a, like all desires, is a property that exists in the self. Our awareness, our cognition, is also basically in the self. But and we're there's a whole biology to this which is irrelevant, other than that fact.
Okay.
So it's these considerations in favor of.
Considerations also exist in the self. They exist outside, and the self is.
No. The considerations have to exist in the self, because if you say what you should say is paramal. You're saying it's a consideration. A consideration is not a nyaya category. It's neither dravya guna. It's nothing. So what is it? What do you mean by consideration? You can't say that. Gangesha doesn't use the word consideration. It's not paramarsha or something. So what is it? Well, it seems to me that these considerations are basically jnanas. It seems to me. I'm not sure about that. But they're either jnanas or they're some kind... I'm pretty sure they're jnanas, actually. But I can't... He doesn't say this anywhere. So, from Gangesha's third-person standpoint of evaluation, then, a person who forms a desire to phi or to get water on the basis of genuinely instigating awareness does so for motivating and normative reasons, which can both be explained by her desire for phi. What's a motivating reason? Just something that pushes you. What's a normative reason? Something that you're accountable to. So my claim is that in this desire for phi, you have built into it both motivating and normative reasons. And these are, like, important terms among the so-called... contemporary Humeans who do this. And their theories are so lame compared to this one, in my opinion. Sorry, it's on tape, but we should not post my remarks on the web. I'll give you the talk. I'm going to get in big trouble. Okay. Alright. So a desire for phi can be motivationally efficacious and also make one count as having acted for a reason. And my interpretation, then, Gangesha's broadly dispositional account of desire for accounts for both the motivational and the normative reasons that an agent has to form a desire to phi. If this is even approximately an adequate account of how the transition between instigating awareness and a desire to phi is to be explained, what remains is to explain how, according to Gangesha, a desire to generates a motivation to. Right? We're supposed to be here on my story. Now I got to tell you how a desire to get the water actually leads to whatever this motivation is for you to get it. You think the desire and motivation are the same thing. We know they're not the same thing because according to Nyaya, they can't be the same thing. Because a desire is a desire. And a motivation is a motivation. They're not the same. but they're pretty close, as you'll see. The transition from a desire to phi, that is having a desire to act upon the means, to actually get the water, or to say turn the tap on, to being motivated to phi, that is having motivation to the means, is importantly different from the transition from instigating awareness to a desire to phi, since the transition from a desire to act to motivation is one between awareness events that both have world-to-word directions of fit, right? They're both the same direction of fit. In both of these awareness events, we're almost done. In both of these awareness events, the primary constituent of content is not an action, but either a desire, as in the case of the desire to act, or effort, as in the case of motivation to the means. Or what does that mean? All awareness events are about something. What they're about has a structure. The structure has one primary thing and a bunch of secondary things. The primary thing in the desire to act is an action. But the primary thing in the other case is not, right? Just because actions and motivations are different. So they can't say they're the same exactly. So in my view, it is Gangesha's implicit commitment to what is called a motivational theory of desire for awareness events in which desire is the primary constituent of content that accounts for this transition. According to many motivational accounts, to desire that P is just to be motivated, is just to be motivated, to make it the case that P. Since for Gangesha, desire and motivation are different kinds of things, his version of the motivational account has to be merely causal, in the sense that an awareness event which has a desire toward making it the case that P as its primary constituent, is that okay? Causes an awareness event which has motivation toward making it the case that P. That's it. On such a view, being motivated to phi is generated simply by our awareness of having a desire to phi. What motivates one to the means on this view just is the desire to act upon the means. In this sense, one cannot be motivated to the means without desire. This is the end. In this paper, I've tried to provide a very preliminary interpretation of Gangesha's theory of action, and have argued that it is based on two theories of desire, a dispositional theory of a desire for the means, right, that's the sugar, and a motivational theory of a desire to act upon the means. On my interpretation of Gangesha's view, when desire is a secondary constituent of the content of an awareness event, that is a visheshana or a prakara, remember, awareness events are about something, what they're about has structure. One thing in the structure is the main thing, and another thing is subordinate. So desire functions differently depending on whether it is a primary thing or a secondary thing. So when it's a secondary constituent, it's dispositional. While when it's the primary constituent, it's motivational. I argued further that through its dispositional interpretation of a desire for, Gangesha tries to account for both motivating and normative reasons. When Gangesha's chapter on command utterances is understood in the terms of the transitions discussed in this paper, it becomes apparent that it's about issues of philosophical significance, both for the history of Sanskrit philosophy and for the history of philosophy more broadly. Some of these issues have to do with the philosophy of action, as is evident from Gangesha's discussion of motivation to the means, and his account of motivating and normative reasons for action. Furthermore, when it is noticed that Gangesha's account of instigating awareness is also the basis for his analysis of the semantics and pragmatics of indicative, optatives, and imperatives, it becomes apparent that his chapter on command utterances also touches, at least in part, on the issue of linguistic force. This range of topics is, of course, not only directly relevant to meta-ethics, the philosophy of action, and the philosophy of language, but it also touches on issues in moral psychology, epistemology, and philosophy of mind. If there was any doubt before, I hope that it is now at least clear that discussions of command utterances in Indian philosophy are not just about what Vedic utterances convey. Gangesha's jewel is a remarkable window onto at least 500 years of philosophical history in India, and yet it is a text that we've only just begun to learn how to see through and think with. This essay has, in a very preliminary way, attempted to contribute to this effort by trying to show why a topic that has seemed to be so uninteresting, unimportant, and irrelevant to so many ought not to be. That's it. So again, it was just simply trying to explain this, and I think maybe one way to get through is try to figure out if we can understand what he's saying and whether we think it's any good.
Can I ask a little question?
If I spoke in Sanskrit, you'd have understood everything.
Exactly.
That's what I probably should have done.
I'm going to make the mistake of diving in before I completely understand why you want to.
That shouldn't stop me.
But one question is, okay, so we have, there's just one of these things, it's awareness, and all of these are different kinds of awareness, mm-hmm. contents that have different kinds of motivational force or normative force or whatever. And it's an interesting analysis in that sense. One thing I'm curious about is, in the case of a desire for that does not lead to action, i.e., it's simply, he's not saying here that as soon as you desire something, you want to go get it, and so on and so forth. So you might, and the pleasure model is interesting, so I might experience pleasure, and he could almost be saying, as soon as I have pleasure, I want more. Okay, but there are kinds of pleasure where you experience it, and you think, that was nice, but I don't want any more.
Right.
Right.
Too much of a good thing.
Yeah, too much of a good thing, or et cetera, et cetera. And what I'm curious about, in a sense, is whether that's... Now, one model of that is that he's having a desire... He has the pleasure thing, and he's like, oh, I want more. But when he then sees, I can see how I can get it, and the other part, would it lead to something worse? He then says, oh, wait, it's going to lead to something worse.
Yeah.
Okay, so then it's a certain kind of desire, but one of those motivational levels is inhibiting him.
One of the conditions, the capability condition or the relative value condition, is not satisfied.
Exactly, and if it was the capability condition, he would still want it just as much, but it would be
he'll be frozen.
The action part would be hurt.
He'll be frozen in having a desire for not. That he cannot. That will not. You won't make the transition. He would like to.
He'd like to be, but he'd also like it to become a desire too. But actually, it won't.
It won't.
Whereas the difference is, he wants it, but actually, he doesn't want it because something bad would get in the way. It's part of a larger thing. In which case, he no longer wants it to turn into a desire too.
The issue of what he doesn't want is, what the problem is not the desire. The problem is the action you'd have to undertake in order to satisfy, in order to get that desire. So if I want pleasure, right? I experience pleasure, I want pleasure by definition.
Yeah.
Now you say you want more pleasure, okay? To get more pleasure, you have to do something. So now the issue is doing that get me more pleasure? That's the capability condition. I mean, capability condition. And you may conclude that, no, I can't really do that. So therefore, even though I still want it, I'm not going to act. I'm not going to make a transition from my awareness of this desire, which I feel, to actually doing something. Or you may say, hey, you know, I can do that. But if I do that, you know, I'm going to get beaten up, or I'm going to die. And then I still have the question is, what happens? I still have the desire for the pleasure, but not to act in that way. I might seek another means. That's what he'd say.
But then we've got three different levels of why you might not. I mean, there's one is just, I can't do it. One is that if I do it, let's ignore the I can't find the way to do it.
Yeah.
That just means you're stupid, but you want it just as much.
Then
you've got the level that you want it, but if you go down that road, you'll get eaten by a wolf.
Yeah.
And that's a downer, right?
Right.
So it doesn't help you get there. But you still want the thing just as much in the actual object itself. There's another version where you want the object, but then you see that if you get the object, regardless of what action you take, it will lead to other problems. So I'm thinking here of an ascetic who says, I'm feeling this pleasure, I love the pleasure, but I don't want any more.
Right.
And we're very clear that there are kinds of desires that you one can choose not to have. Now, what I'm curious about is whether he would say that something you experience... He's saying that there are certain kinds of cognitive contents that are intrinsically inclined to inspire desires.
Yeah, that certain things push you.
Well, desires for, right?
Okay, desires for, yes.
So then you either, this is where I'm trying to get my words right, either you desire it, but you see other things surrounding it, which it... Not inhibiting factors in the action to get it, but inhibiting factors in the design, in the actual thing, which cause you no longer to desire it in the same way. Either it's that, so it's something
I get it.
Mm-hmm. At a level after having the desire that causes you then to not act upon the desire, or the difference is that you actually have a cognition. It's a different kind of a cognition of desire.
Right.
In which case, some cognitions of desire immediately lead you to want more, and some cognitions of desire look very similar.
Mm-hmm.
But something about it, before you even get to questions of how to get it
or
what it will lead to, make you enjoy it but not want
more. So let's see if we can flesh that out. Right. What would such a thing be? So the idea is that I have an instigating awareness, right? And that instigating awareness, one component of it is that something is a means to my desired end. And what we're talking about is my desired end. And now what Jessica's saying is, look, yes, you've said that if these two conditions are satisfied, a person will have a desire to act. But suppose someone learns something, right? You learn something, and so you no longer have that awareness of something as a means to a desired end, because you no longer have a desire for that end. That's the idea, right? Mm-hmm. So the question is, we can imagine many, and you wanted me specifically to say, look, it's not blocked because you don't know the means. And it's not blocked because you think really bad things will happen to you. It's because you've learned something, you just no longer have it, very frankly. Right? You just no longer have it. That's the story, kind of.
I think. Uh-huh.
So the question is whether we can take this reasons for no longer having it and collapse them into the one of the other two or not.
Yeah, I think I want to know if...
That's basically the challenge.
If it's simply one account of pleasure, things that cause desire, but that can then be overridden, or whether it's actually two... If he wants to really claim that you get an immediate desire from that cognition, whether there must be two different kinds of cognitions of pleasure that he's talking about, and some of your tasting sugars make you want more sugar, and some of your tasting sugars don't make you want more sugar intrinsically in the actual phenomenological cognitive content of that thing.
So what that would mean is, in the case where intrinsically tasting sugar, right, isn't pleasurable, it wouldn't be a mean. You wouldn't then have any means to it. It wouldn't be a desired end.
That's what I mean. He's got two accounts of pleasure, because normally we would say some pleasures you can have, but they don't make you desire.
So a pleasure, yeah. So you're, yeah. So basically, you're saying, look, oh, this is good. So you have a pleasure force. You have pleasure. What if that's enough? Right. You have, say, one.
The aesthetics is a normal example.
One lifesaver. Really enjoy it. Great pleasure. You don't have any interest in taking another one. The issue is why. He would probably build that into, because you think that taking another lifesaver would lead to something you don't want.
Mm. And it's not the action get to, but the actual pleasure itself. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then there's another, that's another level.
It's kind of all parsed into the same thing as part of the problem. In his view. Right, so let me see if I got this right.
An aesthetic, in aesthetics is usually where you get the example of a pleasure which has no further motivational or desire. It's the pleasure without desire.
Right. That's how
I listen to Bach, it was great, yep. I don't need to do it all the time, that'd be crazy.
Yep.
And often one would say that's a different kind of pleasure from the kind that generates desire. But
yeah, he says no.
It's not.
Yeah, no, okay. It's all the same. Because look, whether you like it or not, he says, there's pleasure and there's suffering. Mm-hmm. That's it. Now, pleasure, no one says that there's one kind that is not internally differentiated. What you have to show is that what you claim are two distinct subtypes of pleasure warrant a different account of action. Mm-hmm. Until you can do that, I can say, yeah, there's 50 kinds of... Actually, there's 11 kinds of pleasure. But that's how he would do it.
Yeah.
And that's the strategy, right?
Okay.
So what we'd have to do to argue against this on those grounds is say, look, there is a kind of pleasure that we all seem to acknowledge, which must be included in the nihilist somewhere. And what's interesting about that kind of pleasure, if that is the desired end that you seek, then this account of action is inadequate to explain it, because that kind of desired end will not lead to this transition or something. And that would be a very good way to go, to say that the account of desire is not nuanced enough, and therefore the philosophical theory glides over, right, masks over the diversity of desires that one could have, or desired ends one could have. But he would say, no, it doesn't. They would draw the line there. It would be too hard, I think, down the road to try to fight that
fight. Or he would just say that's not pleasure in the way that we would.
He would either say it's not pleasure, or he would say it fits into my category, or he would say you haven't met your burden of proof to show me that it warrants something distinct. Mm-hmm. That's how it would go. But with literature, or even when Russ theorists talk about this, so rasa swada, for example, right, the relishing of an aestheticized emotion, that's just considered sukha for these guys. Same.
As in happiness rather than desire?
As in pleasure. It just,
as in pleasure.
Yeah, that's it. So they don't think, for example, Nyayika, if you look at Nyaya commentators on something like Kavya Prakasha, for example, they don't have to have this on there.